Life Takes Guts with Nidhi Swaroop. Hi, and welcome to the podcast series from the Crohn's and Colitis Society of Singapore. We will be bringing practical information to patients diagnosed with Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis. Family members and friends will also gain a better understanding of our life after diagnosis. We believe that our conversations will bring hope and empowerment to you as we journey together. A very well-respected pediatric gastroenterologist from the National University Hospital, Singapore, is with us today. We are beginning to see people getting diagnosed with inflammatory bowel diseases. Let us hear from her, what are these diseases? Do children get Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis?
Hello and welcome to this episode organized by the Crohn's and Colitis Society of Singapore. We will be talking about Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis in young patients. Today we have with us Associate Professor Marian Au, who is currently a senior consultant at the Division of Pediatric Gastroenterology, Nutrition, Hepatology and Liver Transplantation at the National University Hospital in Singapore, and Associate Professor at the Yong Loo Lin School of Medicine, National University of Singapore. Welcome, Dr. Marian.
Thank you, Nidhi.
For the benefit of our listeners, could you tell us what is Crohn's disease and how is ulcerative colitis different from Crohn's disease?
Okay. Well, both Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis are conditions that affect the intestines of a person, and there's some form of inflammatory process. In terms of the difference between both Crohn's and ulcerative colitis, mainly it's the way they affect the patient and some of the symptoms the patient may present. In fact, both of them can be quite similar, and at the same time, they can be different. So Crohn's disease is one which can affect any part of the intestine, all the way from the food pipe, the stomach, the small intestine, the large intestines, whereas ulcerative colitis generally affects the large intestine.
Okay. So it's clearly defined in two different parts of our digestive tract.
Well, Crohn's disease tends to be a bit more extensive in the sense it can affect any part of the GI tract, whereas ulcerative colitis, by name, the name suggests colitis, that is predominantly affects the colon, which is the large intestine.
Okay. So what are the typical IBD symptoms in children? Are the symptoms in children different from those in adults?
I would say the symptoms by far are similar, but there could be some distinct differences between children and adults. Definitely, if there is inflammation affecting the intestines, then some of the common symptoms a patient might get would be stomach ache, diarrhea, even blood in the stool. It might affect their appetite, so they don't eat as much or they can't eat as much. They may also affect their nutrition, and the person may not put on weight or grow well. So in adults, where adults have already reached their what we call final adult height and weight, then the effect of suboptimal nutrition would result in weight loss. Whereas in a child, because the child is still actively growing, then what we actually see in the child would be a tailing of the rate of weight gain. Mm. So the child may not put on weight or may not put on height as much as we expect. By the time a child loses weight, that's actually quite serious already, right? Because before you can lose weight, you slow down in your growth or you stop growing. So that would be one of the distinct features between adult patients and children, because children are still growing.
Yeah. Is it common for children to have like low-grade fever for maybe like a month or so?
Yes.
Or even just at night? Is that typical of Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis?
Yes. So definitely intermittent fevers or persistent fevers can be a symptom associated with inflammatory bowel disease, because the IBD is an inflammatory process. So fever is a symptom or can be a symptom. Some patients may not experience the fever, But it's also not uncommon for patients to have persistent fevers. And we do notice that some patients may only have fever alone. So, for example, a patient with Crohn's disease may have intermittent stomach pains and a persistent fever with minimal bowel symptoms. So Crohn's is a little distinct from ulcerative colitis in that patients with ulcerative colitis invariably have diarrhea, stomach pain with diarrhea with or without blood in the stool. Whereas Crohn's patients can have the tummy pain with diarrhea, but they can also have tummy pain without any diarrhea. And that's why sometimes it's much harder to make a diagnosis in patients or children with Crohn's disease because they may not necessarily present with typical gastro symptoms.
Okay. I'm just wondering if these illnesses, both Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis, are they infectious diseases? And are the siblings, let's say, in the family, are the siblings at risk?
By definition, they are not infectious. So you can't catch Crohn's or ulcerative colitis from somebody who has it, right? So it's not an infectious condition in that sense. Now, whether or not there might be some genetic components, so would you say that if a family member has inflammatory bowel disease, does it increase another family member's risk of it? I think there could be a slightly higher risk in families. At the same time, we have, you know, studies have suggested there are some genes associated with a higher chance of inflammatory bowel disease, but the link is not 100%. So it doesn't mean that just because a family member has ulcerative colitis or Crohn's that you would definitely get it. No, that's definitely not the case.
Okay. I believe these illnesses would be under the category of autoimmune diseases. Could you just elaborate on what causes autoimmune diseases?
Okay. I would say sometimes we might need to confess that we're not as smart as we like to think we are, right? So sometimes we're not quite sure why a particular person develops an autoimmune condition. Basically, an autoimmune condition means the body attacks itself. So your immune system somehow is a bit dysregulated, and then your immune cells attack your own body. So, for example, in inflammatory bowel disease, you get inflammation and injury and ulcers in your intestine as a result of that immune process. There have been some studies to suggest that whether or not it could be a switch in the microbiota or any other early influences in childhood that might increase one's risk of getting IBD. These are all just early studies that have suggested a possible link, whether the use of extensive antibiotics in early life, whether it's directly or indirectly because the use of antibiotics might change your gut flora or your microbiota, and that indirectly increases one's risk of immune phenomenon within the gut.
But when it comes to antibiotics, they would be given when we have any kind of infection. So are you saying that we should be taking them when there is an infection, but maybe parents should be cautious not to just go overboard and start dispensing antibiotics, because we do come across certain parents who purchase it and keep antibiotics at home for a so-called emergency need for it.
Yes.
So is that...
That is extremely important because it's not uncommon for young children to get infections, but by far and large, these infections are viruses, and the body can actually overcome viral infections quite easily. And viruses actually don't respond to antibiotics. So a lot of times we don't need to give antibiotics for a bit of flu or a bit of viral fever and things like that. Yeah. So definitely we need to be careful about when we use antibiotics. Definitely if there was an infection caused by a bacteria, then antibiotics may be indicated at that time. And we always need to be just careful in the way we use and prescribe antibiotics.
Thanks for that clarification. Because, I do come across parents who are a bit confused about the use between or not even knowing if it's a bacterial infection or a viral infection and just using antibiotics mm-hmm. as a cure-all. Yeah. When it comes to autoimmune diseases that we were briefly talking about, is there a cure to such diseases or is it a chronic condition?
Yeah. Unfortunately, most of these are long-term conditions, so chronic in that sense. They would last for years or sometimes even almost one person's whole lifetime. Mm-hmm. So they are tough conditions to have in that sense. Mm-hmm. The good thing is that we do have medications and things that can control the condition such that the person with that autoimmune condition can probably live life as full as possible or as normal as possible, other than the fact that they have to, you know, take medications and go for medical checkups.
So when we were talking about the causes of, let's say, Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis, you touched on the point that it has some genetic component. So we do come across parents who have a sense of guilt that maybe it was in their genes that led to the child's illness. In such situations, what advice would you give to parents?
Yeah. So I think the important thing is to realize there's nothing that the parent did or didn't do in order for the child to actually have it. So most times parents wonder, especially moms, I think, whether it's something they ate during pregnancy, something they did during pregnancy that increased the child's risk. And I want to sort of reassure all parents or moms to say there is nothing that they did or didn't do during pregnancy that would have, you know, increased the child's chance of having this. You know, and once again, you know, I emphasize the fact that we're all not smart enough to know why certain things happened, you know.
Yeah.
So it's not something that you did or didn't do that resulted in your child having the IBD.
Yeah. So these conditions are actually a combination of factors. Science hasn't come up with specific answers,
no,
right?
Yes. If we did, we would be so happy, right? We'll be able to cure everything and to prevent things from happening. Yeah.
True. So going forward, is there a diagnostic test to quickly let us know if the child has Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis?
Okay. Yeah. So I would say when we come to tests, there could be some things which I consider like screening tests to give us indication that something might be going on. So if a child might have symptoms to suggest inflammation of the gut, whether it's Crohn's or ulcerative colitis, then the doctor might want to do some blood tests or stool tests. And there is actually a stool test called the fecal calprotectin test, which is a marker of inflammation in the intestines. So if that result is high, it might point to the fact that the child has some form of inflammation. Now, we need to be careful because this test is sensitive. So anything that causes infection or inflammation in the gut will result in a high result. So if you had food poisoning or if you had infection of the gut because you've got a bacterial infection or a viral infection of your intestines, the result will also be high. So we need to be careful who we test, do that test in. But if we are suspecting the possibility of inflammatory bowel disease and the stool calprotectin was high, then that might lend support to that suspicion. Okay, so these would be screening tests that give us an indication maybe something is going on. Now, the diagnostic test in terms of confirming whether somebody has inflammation in the gut or not would be endoscopy. So that is putting down a scope through the mouth to look at the food pipe in the stomach, or through the anus, the backside, to look at the large intestine. And the scope test will allow the doctor to look at the intestine while they're doing the scope and at the same time take biopsies or tissue from the intestine to examine under the microscope to see whether there's evidence to suggest the patient has inflammation of the intestine. And if so, what that inflammation is due to.
So you have covered the fecal calprotectin or the stool test as well as the endoscopy or colonoscopy that is done. Are there even some kind of blood tests mm-hmm. that need to be done?
Yeah. So in terms of blood tests, it's hard to say that they're diagnostic in that sense, but they can give us an idea or clue that something is going on. So, for example, if a person comes in with stomach ache, some chronic diarrhea, and when we do the blood test, we see there's evidence of a low blood count. So the patient is anemic. then we need to say, why is the patient anemic? Is the patient anemic because there's not enough iron in the diet? Or is the patient anemic because the patient is losing blood in the intestine? Or is the patient anemic because there's a chronic illness that just makes it higher risk for the patient to be anemic? So we need to explain why we see the abnormal test. So the blood count would give us an idea that something is going on, but it's not as specific in telling us what is going on, right? Mm-hmm. But when we look at the patient as a whole, then we can say, yes, it is possible that the low blood count is because of inflammation or blood loss from the intestine. If the patient is having, for example, tummy pain and bloody diarrhea that's been going on for a few months, mm-hmm. then we put the picture together and says, yes, that is highly suspicious or suggestive of a particular condition. So I think blood tests right now give us a clue. They are part and parcel of what we call the diagnostic workup of a patient, but blood tests per se cannot 100% tell us this patient has inflammatory bowel disease, but it can make us suspect it.
Okay. Would you also then recommend x-rays or CT scans for children?
Okay, so if it comes to investigations, imaging, that means whether we want to do special tests, I would say the ultrasound is not a bad test, but the ultrasound is very dependent on who is doing the ultrasound. So we call it operator dependent. And I have found it useful if I suspect that a child might have inflammation in the intestine, because the ultrasound can show that the intestine wall is a bit thickened. So again, it's a non-specific sign, because it could be thickened because the patient has gastroenteritis, could have an infection of the intestine, but it tells me something is going on. So if I had a patient who was having tummy pain, not eating very well, weight gain not so good, and I do an ultrasound and I look at the intestine and the intestines are thickened, then I'd be worried that something is going on in the intestine. So it's actually a good test to sort of make me think, okay, I need to pursue that a little bit more. CT scans, we try very hard not to do CT scans because that's radiation. Another type of investigation that is useful could be a MRI test. So an MRI test is a bit like a CT scan. It doesn't have radiation, and it can look at the intestines, the stomach quite well. But one of the things is cost. It's actually quite an expensive test to do. And depending on what exactly we are trying to image in the body, the stomach area or the intestines, we may or may not need to actually do what we call bowel prep. That means clean out the intestines so that we can see them well. Yeah, so again, it depends on what we're trying to achieve and what we're trying to do. So I would say the ultrasound is probably a useful test in terms of screening to give us an idea of what is going on. And after we've made a diagnosis of inflammation or that the patient may have IBD, then the MRI might be useful if there are certain targeted reasons why we want to do the MRI to look at more of the intestine. Because you will realize that, for example, when we do the scope test, we can only see the stomach and then we can see the large intestine. And there's quite a fair bit of small intestine we cannot see. So sometimes we might want to look at the small intestine using ultrasound or using the MRI.
When it comes to then maybe classifying the illness, you've already shared if it's in the large intestine, it would most likely be ulcerative colitis. And if there are ulcers across the digestive tract, it could be Crohn's disease. But going further, what are the different levels of severity in these two illnesses?
Okay. Yeah. Maybe just to clarify that both conditions can actually result in ulcers. And what is important sometimes is the way they look. They might look slightly different on endoscopy, and they may and they would definitely look different in terms of the histology, so the microscopic appearance, right? So not only is the extent of disease or which part of the gut is affected might be slightly different between the two, but they may look different when the doctor does the scope, and they definitely have different features under the microscope. So there are actually distinguishing features for both conditions. What was your question again? Sorry.
I was asking if there were different levels of severity.
Okay. Yeah. So when we talk about levels of severity, we could always say whether it's mild, moderate, or severe. And there are some ways to classify severity of symptoms. Sometimes we also look at it in terms of extent of disease. It means how large or which parts of the intestines are affected and how severe in terms of how deep or extensive the ulcers are. So if only a small part of the intestine is affected or is patchy involvement and the ulcers are very few or superficial, then we think maybe that's mild disease. If the ulcers are very deep or there are complications associated with the ulcers, then we would consider it more severe. If the patient had high spiking temperature, looked very unwell, had lost a lot of weight, then of course we would be more concerned that this is severe disease rather than mild disease.
Okay, so when you mentioned that there could be certain complications associated with the severe form of the disease, could you just briefly touch on what kind of complications can come along?
Okay. So for example, with Crohn's disease, so in Crohn's disease, you can have this bowel wall becoming what we call strictured or fibrosed, so it's narrowing of the intestines, and that can cause blockage or obstruction. You could also have what we call fistulas. That means the bowel has abnormal connections to the skin or to other parts of the body, which means connections which shouldn't be there. And that also is a complication of the disease. We call them fistulas. And sometimes these are actually very difficult to control and actually potentially unpleasant for the patient to have also. Some of them are more serious in the sense that if you have a fistula between intestine to intestine or intestine to another organ, it can actually cause quite a lot of problems. Sometimes if it's a fistula from intestine to skin, then maybe the problem might be more uncomfortable and unpleasant rather than a severe medical problem. But all fistulas go, you know, difficult to manage medically and definitely are a concern for the doctor and the patient to manage.
So when you say there is a connection, the fistula, is it, I'm trying to think of it in layman terms, could it be described as a tube or an extension of the intestine going from one part to another part? Is that like a bridge?
Yeah. So it's like a connection or tubular bridge or connection between the intestine and another part of the body which should not have been there.
Yeah. Okay. So then the food that is digested would actually go along two directions. Yeah.
Yes.
And that's
correct.
Where the discomfort and the problems, complications.
Yeah. And come it
in.
Can get infected. You can have pus collecting. You can be quite sick with that, yeah.
Yeah, so those are the very severe types of Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis. Yeah.
So ulcerative colitis may not necessarily form fistulas like Crohn's. So classically, the fistulas and fissures are with Crohn's disease. Whereas in ulcerative colitis, it's mainly bloody diarrhea and significant inflammation. And when it's very severe, the patient can be quite sick, can be high spiking temperature. You could even cause the intestines to break and you might perforate. And that can be life-threatening.
So when it comes to the ages of children, how young a child could get this kind of illness, you know?
Yeah.
Is it only after they start having solid food or even earlier? Can they infants get it?
Okay, so I would say theoretically any age, yeah. But classically, the age group would usually, at least in our local population, probably above the age of 2 or 3 years old. We do have some young children less than 6. We have quite a number of our patients less than 6 who actually present. But I would probably say less than 2 would be less likely. Having said that, it's not impossible. So we've had some children who are diagnosed in infancy. That means in the first year of life. But this would be rare. The comment I would probably make is that the younger the child presents with inflammation of the intestines, that means less than 2 years of age, the more concerned we are there might be a genetic component or some mutations in that child. Doesn't mean 100% they will have it, but the chance that they will have it might be slightly higher than if they had inflammation for the first time at age 10 or 8. You know, so an older child would less likely have a genetic mutation. A very young child, less than 1 or 2, might have a higher chance of having a mutation. That's why the child presented so early.
Early. Okay. Yeah. Wow. It does leave us a bit unsettled when we hear of such things because there are more, a whole lot of questions come to our minds when we see young children falling sick.
Yes.
And out of goodwill, actually, our family and friends then come forward and they suggest various alternative treatments and they come up with dietary recommendations. Now, can parents discuss these with the pediatric gastroenterologist?
I would say definitely, because I think whatever concerns parents have, it's important that they discuss it with their doctor, because only when they share with their doctor their concerns and they can get answers to what they're worried about, then can they feel at peace with whatever medications they're doing. And it's also important that the doctor understands what the parents are thinking, and if the parents want to do something which is a little bit different, at least the doctor can understand if the child is doing well or not doing so well with treatment, why that might be so. And I would say nutrition is extremely important for kids, right? And nutrition mainly comes from food that we eat. So as long as the diet is nutritious and complete with all the so-called what we call macronutrients, carbohydrates, proteins, fats, and micronutrients, which are mainly the vitamins and the minerals, then the child should grow if the disease is under control. You know, there's a lot out there, I think, you know, that you can read on the internet, or you can get advice from people. They may say certain diets might help. I think there's some evidence that there's specific diets that might be helpful, and the evidence is more for Crohn's than for ulcerative colitis. And these diets are definitely worth exploring. But I would say from a medical perspective that the diets should be done in complement with medication. So far, you know, in terms of long-term treatment and cure, we don't have the confidence to say that if you take a particular diet, you would be cured of your condition and you don't have to take medicines. I don't think we are there yet.
Yeah.
We're not there in terms of being smart enough to figure out, is there a diet such that when you take this diet, you don't have to take medications. But I think there is definitely some evidence that certain diets will be complementary to the food you eat, to the medications you take, and it's worth exploring. Mm. It may work for some patients, it may not work for all patients. And therefore, I would say if parents are keen, it's worth exploring and then deciding for yourself whether that is worth doing or not.
We also understand that each person, each child, in fact, is different. And we need to identify the trigger foods, yeah? So what in your opinion, is the best way to identify a child's trigger food?
Okay. I think one is to actually maybe start off by doing a food diary to sort of record down what the child is eating and to see whether certain foods trigger more symptoms, and then have that conversation either with a dietitian or your doctor, child's doctor. We need to be careful that food can cause symptoms or reactions for a variety of reasons, right? And for example, there are some foods that people say, oh, does it cause more bloating? Does it cause more crampy pains? And we do realize that certain foods tend to cause more bloating. So for example, some high fiber foods could cause more bulk. And when there's more bulk, the patient may feel bloated, right? And we do recognize that some patients with inflammatory bowel disease also have a component of irritable bowel syndrome or irritable bowel symptoms.
Okay, so, IBS.
Yes, mm-hmm. IBS. Mm-hmm. And sometimes people get a bit confused between what is IBD and IBS, right?
True.
And the two can coexist. So for example, if you have IBD, your intestine may be a little bit inflamed. So when you overstretch it, you know, when you distend it with either fiber or gas, you might have a bit of pain. And that pain is from the distension and not from the inflammation. So foods that you eat that can cause distension, you may say, oh, I get more pain when I eat this food. But it's actually from the distension and not from inflammation. But eating that food causes the discomfort. So you would say, I would eat less of that food. So you're right in saying eat less of the food that causes a symptom. But that hasn't changed inflammation at all.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
So patients sometimes get a little bit, they need to see the subtle but important difference between foods that cause symptoms because of a mechanical issue like distension versus things that actually might change inflammation. Yeah.
And overall, would you say that children can lead a normal life after diagnosis, and how can children actually be able to do that?
Yeah. So I would say the aim of treatment is to make them live as normal a life as possible. You know, I would consider myself having failed if they can't.
Yes.
Of course, there's some children who have very severe disease that makes it a bit more challenging for them. But if we are able to control, the goal is to control the illness as best as we can so that the child can live as normal a life as possible. And that would mean going to school, participating in activities and things like that. And generally, by far and large, if we can get the condition under control, most children with IBD can live as normal a life as possible. The only thing we need to be careful about is depending on the medications they are taking. Okay, so some of the medicines that used to treat IBD, what we call immunosuppressants. So they might depress your body's immune system, which means you might be a little bit more prone to catching germs and infections compared to a child who's not taking those medications. So the only cautionary note I would say for parents of children on immunosuppressants is that their ability to fight common childhood conditions like chickenpox and measles and hand, foot, mouth would be a bit less than the average child. So I would be a bit more cautious about exposing the child to these sort of common childhood infections. Yeah, so that would be probably the only thing I would say to be careful about exposing the child to infections. One common thing that I think, if I may say, so parents always want to know whether the child can, you know, participate in school camps and activities that are outdoors. And my general take on that is, if the child is on an immunosuppressant, then there might be some restrictions. If the school camp is in the school building, then probably it's okay, right? Okay. But if the camp was an outward bound, you have to pitch a tent, dig a hole for making your own food, or dig a hole to pass stool, then I think that might be a risky activity which maybe a child on immunosuppression should not take part in. So there would be some considerations in terms of lifestyle modification because the child is taking certain medications.
Okay. And going a few years down the road with the treatment, if a child is doing well and is symptom-free, could we consider like stopping the medication for a short while, maybe a few months or maybe a few years? Yeah. Is that a possibility?
I mean, I think that would be the desire of all parents as well as doctors, that their patients can be so well to stop medications. For a child, I think that we would need to consider very carefully that the condition truly is under control and in what we call remission. And some people would say, to what degree of remission is the child in, right? So when we talk about symptoms, then you would say, I'm in clinical remission when I'm symptom-free. I don't have symptoms of the IBD. Then after that, there could be some testing that we can do to establish that truly the condition is under control. So we might do blood tests and the stool fecal calprotectin to see that the markers of inflammation are low. So if the stool fecal calprotectin is within the normal range or very low, that might also lend support to the fact that the gut inflammation is low. Then we call that biochemical remission. That means remission from the point of test. And of course, the holy grail, I think, that we always hope that we can achieve is, if you do a scope for the child, is the scope normal? And that's what we call endoscopic remission. That means the lining of the intestine now looks as normal as it could. So when it comes to stopping medication, I think, you know, the goal is, if we can result in what we call a normal intestine lining, that means your intestines has more or less healed completely for a period of time, then there's a good chance that if you stop medication, the disease won't come back. Because the main concern for IBD is that when you stop the medicines, the disease would come back within the year. Within 1 year, the disease might recur again, or what we call relapse. But if the intestine looks normal on the scope, then you have a higher chance that this would not happen. Yeah. So for kids, I always tell parents to say that if you want to make sure that the kid is doing well, growing well, and for children, particularly pubertal growth spurt is important. So we generally don't want to rock the boat, so to speak, you know, to adjust your medications or stop the medications when we're expecting the child to grow maximally during puberty. Because when we stop medicines and the child becomes sick again, you potentially lose that growth potential. Right. And that's something we don't want to do. So we generally don't stop medication during puberty. We would probably like the child to have completed puberty and still be well. Then we might want to stop the medication, because there's always this niggling fear that when I stop medicine, the child might become sick again.
Yes. And then there's a lag between restarting and the medicine actually being effective.
Yes, right? and getting things under control again.
There are just so many things that we also hear about microbiome, and so that's where I started thinking about going forward. What is it that parents can expect from the scientific community in terms of treatment options or to improve the quality of life of children?
I think the research is always there to try and figure out how can we produce drugs that are more effective and safer. So I think people are still looking at that to say, can we reach that whereby we have drugs which are more potent, who control the condition with fewer side effects. So I think that's where the current research is. There's also research being looked at to see whether we can predict who is at risk. I think that will happen at some point, but we're still far from being able to do those prediction models. There's also studies looking at to see how can we predict response of patient to treatment. That means which patient will do better with which drug. Then you call it precision medicine or individualized therapy. You know, when we do studies on drugs on patients, we would say, oh, drug X will work well on 80% of patients. But which can we predict which 80% would do well and which 20% wouldn't? So sometimes we're not quite there yet, right? So even though the drug is effective for a lot of people, it is less effective for a smaller proportion. And can we predict upfront who will respond well or who wouldn't? Because then we can save the pain of putting the patient through a certain therapeutic regime and then realizing after 6 months that the patient hasn't responded. So I think we are trying to do research in those areas to figure out which patient would respond better to which drug.
That'll be extremely useful and very reassuring for the parents that we know in advance we are putting the child through this treatment.
Yep.
And the outcome is kind of assured. Yeah. So we look forward to all that, the hope for the best, and sincerely looking forward to good outcomes so that we can prevent the illness going forward in more children, managing those patients who already have the illness, and improving quality of life for each one of them.
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Prof. Marian, for your time today with us. Very big thank you from all the members of Crohn's and Colitis Society of Singapore, as well as our management committee members. Thank you very much for your time.
Most welcome. It's been a pleasure too on my side. Yeah.
Thanks.
Thank you.
We hope you found today's conversation useful, and we look forward to you joining us in the next episode. For more information about joining the patient support group, please contact the Crohn's and Colitis Society of Singapore. You can reach us via email at admin@ibd.org.sg or WhatsApp at +65 9756 4066. Do visit our website www.ibd.org.sg to know more about our annual seminar, financial assistance schemes, and how you could join us as a member, meet other patients, as well as parents of children living with IBD.